Hey, I'm Tori and I'm at Halakahiki Tiki in River Grove and you're listening to Outside the Loop, Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine.
Thank you very much. Welcome to Outside the Loop. Yes, this is Chicago's almost above ground audio magazine. I am Mike Steven. It's great to be here with you today for show number 998. What we do here on the program is take a look at local issues and topics that don't always get mainstream media attention. Bob Ferguson is our wonderful engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. So hello to Bob. And I hope you had a lovely Thanksgiving. Don't sleep on those mashed potatoes. That's my favorite side dish. I am not ashamed to admit that. Maybe even like it better than turkey? More mashed potatoes and gravy, please. Hey, just want to say thanks to everyone who came out to the Outside the Loop 1000th episode taping last weekend at Fitzgerald's in Berwyn. We had a fantastic time. And that show will air in a couple weeks. And boy, it was a good one. So much fun and just great seeing all the listeners, the WGN radio listeners and podcast listeners. One gentleman drove up from Indianapolis. That's amazing. From Indianapolis to Berwyn, Illinois. So thank you to everyone who came out. It was a great night. I'm excited to get that show on the air and on the podcast. And hey, we've got a great show today. So stick around. If you're in your turkey coma, that's cool. We got you covered. Here's a statistic. There is not a single county in the U.S. where a full-time minimum wage worker can afford to rent a modest apartment. In Chicago, there is a shortage of about 120,000 housing units. And in the state of Illinois, there is a deficit of about 300,000 housing units for low-income renters. So housing is a really big deal. There's a new exhibit running right now at the National Public Housing Museum in Chicago called Breakthrough Housing Futures. This exhibit addresses some history and gets us thinking about the importance of housing in our country. Alexander Eisenschmidt is a professor of architecture at UIC. He's also the curator of this exhibit, Breakthrough Housing Futures, and he is here with us today. And Outside the Loop, Alexander, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. So let's just start kind of with the big question here. We've been talking about housing, I know, on this program and in the national conversation. It is, like I was saying before, a big deal. But okay, we're in a housing crisis here. Why? Why are we in such a housing crisis today?
And you're absolutely right. We are in a housing crisis, but it's also important to articulate that it's not a new crisis. I think every few years we're again talking about a housing crisis, with the knowledge also that it's just an ongoing struggle. In the 19th century, one would say it's an ongoing struggle for the working class. Today, we can say that it's an ongoing struggle for most people, from the homeless to the rent burdened, to the overpaying of mortgage holders. And so it's really an ongoing struggle throughout much of industrialization until today. And why that is? Well, the exhibition that is currently going on in the National Public Housing Museum sort of puts one finger or points at one direction where we're really realizing that there is not much innovation going on in terms of rethinking in the way that housing is designed, is built, and it's financed. And so that's really one of the key issues. And, you know, on top of that, also the U.S. in particular is where the majority of the population is burdened with a mortgage, and where much of that is part of the national consumer debt. We also realize that you know, we live in a system where there is very little incentive, even for the average person, to lobby for affordability for the other. And so we're in a situation where it's a true conundrum, and particularly in the US, that is very hard to escape. And so that's sort of where we are in a nutshell. I mean, this is a longer, maybe
right.
a longer discussion.
Right. And it is complicated. I mean, that, and that's something I think that comes yeah. across here is, you know, there's not necessarily one specific thing in terms of why we are where we are. I mean, this has been, as you say, an issue for a very long time, many, many years. And it's a combination of economics, of policy, also just like you yeah. were saying, how we're actually building houses, like the physicality of it. And what purpose does a single family home versus a multi-unit, you know, building serve? And I think these are all big questions that we have to think about here. But thinking about what's going on in this exhibit, because I think this is really interesting, because you do look at history here. This exhibit, again, called Breakthrough Housing Futures. It's at the National Public Housing Museum in Chicago. So you specifically look back at the outset here to 1969. And yeah. this is where we see the federal government. They're trying to do something about housing. And take us into what this exhibit's about.
I mean, maybe to begin with, the exhibition emerged out of research on affordable collective housing as a real alternative to for-profit, mortgage-based, developer-driven housing, which has, one could say, systematically eradicated affordability. And so to make affordable housing available, we all know that we have to, in a way, radically rethink the way housing is designed, built, managed, and financed. And so a few years ago, we initiated the Housing Futures Initiative that identified housing as a primary form of architecture and one of its main responsibilities, if not today's most crucial task. And that really targets the housing crisis by sort of prototyping advanced, affordable, and sustainable housing designs through spatial and material and construction innovation. And so as I was studying the history of prototypical housing designs, I came across Operation Breakthrough, which I had not heard of before, which is arguably the most ambitious housing program in U.S. history that hardly anyone has ever heard about.
Right.
And so I started to look into it and realizing that it was really one of the most ambitious programs, and which identified essentially that by that time, more than a century long, housing construction and design and technology had largely remained unchanged in the US, and Operation Breakthrough was to change all of that. They initiated it in 69, and the newly founded US Department of Housing and Urban Development, which had just been born, initiated this poignantly titled program. By that time, Congress had already acknowledged that the goal of HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, should be a decent home and a suitable living environment for every American family. That should be the goal of HUD, mm-hmm. which makes total sense. Of course, they should have that exactly that goal, and that goal was for them, for Congress at that time, that is 68-69, that goal was a matter of national concern, if not a matter of national security, and that it was actually possible to realize this goal. They all thought that this was not insurmountable. And so with this objective in mind, Operation Breakthrough was born and was there to really as a jump start of large-scale housing production by industrializing the housing industry with the knowledge that much of the industry or much of housing had not changed the construction. And so they thought, okay, let's industrialize housing. And that would enable it to build no less than 26 million units over the coming decade. That was the ambition. And creating, therefore, adequate, equal opportunity housing for all. And so for the HUT secretary, George Romney, interestingly enough, the father of the later presidential candidate, this was, he would say, it's not just a program designed to see just how cheap we can build a house, but really a way to, as he calls it, breakthrough to total new systems of housing production, financing, marketing, management, and land use. So he really saw this as a radical rethinking of all these aspects that come together when we deal with housing. And so, you know, and it really was the at the beginning of HUT and at the beginning of Operation Breakthrough, really, it was conceived as a program that, unlike other housing programs, which always works via, and we have gotten used to this by now, through financial incentives, Operation Breakthrough sought to increase supply by demonstrating how advanced design and technology can build housing better, faster, and cheaper. So this is radically different from, you know, the voucher system or any of the Section 8 housing, right? Because now, you know, it would facilitate material and technological building innovation. That was the ambition of Operation Breakthrough, and therefore volume production would ensue. Now, volume production never came to pass because by the second Nixon administration, or by the second term of Nixon, that program was canceled. And really, there was a radical shift from subsidizing new construction to essentially rental assistance for low-income families. That's the Section 8 program that we know of today. And so, of course, these new programs that were initiated in 73 never go really to, and that we have today, they never go to the core of affordable housing because they never actually reduce the cost of housing construction. And instead, they sort of keep the price and the demand for housing up.
Yeah. So thinking about that as kind of like the background here, you know, with what you're doing in this exhibit, Breakthrough Housing Futures, that's kind of the context, and you're approaching it through that lens of what the government was trying to do back in the late 1960s. So when we go to this exhibit at the National Public Housing Museum in Chicago, what are we going to experience when we see the exhibit?
Yeah, what you see on display in the gallery walls is a selection of drawings from these 236 housing proposals that HUT received through its open competition. You also see photographs of material tests. One of the they did test all the material and all the prototypes in one-to-one. So you see a splintering floor plate that they maximum strength tested. You also see impressions of the construction sites of those from these nine cities that all had to waive local building and zoning codes in order to accommodate those prototypical designs. And you also see move-in days of two families that move into two of the 2,900 prototypical units. And in response to and expanding on the lessons of this ambitious program, we introduced new housing designs. And so the exhibition presents one scheme that aims to radically rethink the design, construction, and materiality of urban dwelling today.
Yeah. So when we think about this, I mean, the takeaways here, because we're talking about housing, we're talking about how to fundamentally maybe reframe how we think about housing and the approaches to getting more people in housing. So in terms of what you want us to take away when we go there, what is that message? What do you want the folks who go to this to walk out with in their brains?
I think a lot of people have given up on the possibility of affordable housing in the US context. And the hope is that after seeing the exhibition, that it's no longer an impossibility, but a possibility if we collectively rethink the way that housing is constructed, designed, financed, and managed, that there is a possibility if we truly commit to it.
Well, I think this is something that we should all check out. This is a topic we need to kind of keep at the forefront of our minds, because as we've been talking about, we are in a housing crisis, and to see how to get out of that, to have ideas and inspiration, I think that's what this exhibit really does. And this exhibit, again, is called Breakthrough Housing Futures. It's running now through April 19th of 2026. It's at the National Public Housing Museum in Chicago. So we could just go to nphm.org to get more information. And Alexander Eisenschmidt is a professor of architecture at UIC. He's also the curator of this exhibit, Breakthrough Housing Futures. Alexander, thank you so much for talking to us today. This was really fascinating, and I'm excited to check out the exhibit.
Thank you, Mike.
Encouraging and preserving the creativity of artists is really important these days. And all kinds of art can be found in different communities across Chicago, including film. And coming up next weekend, Saturday, December 6th and Sunday, December 7th, there is a special pop-up film festival happening at Columbia College Chicago and the Chicago Department of Cultural Affairs. It's the Robert Townsend Pop-Up Film Festival, and it is being hosted by actor and director Robert Townsend, and he is here with us today on Outside the Loop to talk all about it. Robert, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to talk to you, and hey, you've got Chicago roots, so you love this area, right?
I was born and raised on the west side of Chicago, and that's where it all started for me. And I started in theater there, did my first two films. I was an extra in Mahogany with Billy Dee and Dinah Ross. And I was in Cooley High with Lawrence Hilton Jacobs and Glenn Turman. So, yeah, Chicago's my home.
I love that. You know, and I think, hey, we all know New York. We all know California. And I just got to say, you know, being here in Chicago, there's a lot of, you know, in terms of creativity and entertainment and storytelling, I mean, let's not sleep on Chicago here, because this is a place where it's really happening, isn't it?
No, it really is. You know, I studied at Second City. And when you think about Saturday Night Live, all the people that came out of Second City, and when you think about the Goodman Theater, all the Broadway productions that started there, and then Steppenwolf, you know, that's a staple in the theater community, all the shows that they do. And they just, as a matter of fact, just won the Pulitzer for Purpose on Broadway. So it has started in Chicago. So yeah, Chicago is no joke.
That's right. You know, speaking of all the creativity that's here, I think this is really exciting what you're doing, and pretty cool, because you are doing, like I said before, this special Robert Townsend pop-up film festival. And so let's talk a little bit about what's going on here. Again, this is next weekend. So this is December 6th and 7th. And this is a film festival. But tell us about how this originated. What's the origin story of what you're doing next weekend?
Well, you know, I live in Los Angeles, and I was watching the news, and I was watching all the things that were going on in Chicago as it relates to politics and the West Side and Chicago overall. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I wanted to do my part, you know. And my childhood friend, Carl Brinson, is the president of the West Side NAACP. He's been the president for 10 years, and he's fought the good fight. And so I was like, I want to do something to help, you know, because if anybody gets in trouble because of whatever's going on, I want to be there to help. And so I said, I want to do a fundraiser for the NAACP, as well as the Answer Inc., which is a foundation that helps awareness for autism. And so I said, I'll do this. And so I put together a 2-day film festival. And it's a film festival like on Saturday, next weekend. The first movie we're showing is The Spook Who Sat by the Door. and that's one of my favorite films. Then I'm going to show one of the films that's considered a classic of mine, The Five Heartbeats. And then later that evening, we're going to have a game night. And, you know, you get to play whatever games, you know, I play Dead Whist, which is a card game, but you got spades, mm-hmm. you've got dominoes, you've got all these different games that you can play, Uno, and just raise money for these organizations. And then on Sunday at the Chicago Cultural Center, we're going to have a screening of Meteor Man. You know, my film is a superhero on some right. big screen. And then I've directed several episodes of the new season of Force that we shot in Chicago. And at 2 o'clock, I'm bringing in the cast, one of the showrunners and executive producers, Kenya Chapman, and she's going to join us. And we're going to talk about the show. And then later that night, we've got a comedy show at the Comedy Bar, and Lorel and LaRoyce Hawkins are hosting the show. And got a lot of comedians coming out. So it's going to be a lot of fun, a lot of great time. And we're raising money for two beautiful causes.
You know, and I think that's great. And again, this is happening next weekend, December 6th and 7th. And we can be a part of it. So if we want to get tickets to this, how do we do that, Robert?
If you want to get tickets, all you have to do is go to eventnoir.com. Eventnoir.com. And you can just click on to get tickets. And one thing I totally forgot about, oh my God, next weekend on the 6th, I'm doing a master class. We just added this to the schedule. I'm also a tenured professor at USC, you know, number one film school.
Yeah.
And so at Columbia College on Saturday from 9 until 10:30, I'm doing a master class talking through how I work as an artist and how I create.
I love it, you know, because in this time, and look, you mentioned the politics, and we are all affected by it. I know some of us don't like to talk about it, but look, it's here. There's a lot of stuff going on, and there's been, I think, kind of a trying time for creative people, because maybe we feel like, well, I shouldn't put this out, or if I'm afraid of the blowback, I'm afraid that I'll get sort of shut down or censored. But you know, when you think about what you're trying to do here, and especially benefiting the West Side of Chicago branch of the NAACP, I mean, these stories for especially some communities that have been suffering disinvestment, I mean, this is like a really important thing for people to tell these stories and to get them out there and to feel like they can be their authentic and true selves, you know?
Well, at the end of the day, it's all about freedom and human rights. And as artists, you know, we want to be able to tell the stories we want to tell and not be censored. And so when I saw, and my friend Carl, he has been in the trenches, you know, anytime there's something going down, somebody got shot or somebody needed help or he was there. And so I go, we got to make sure the coffers are filled, especially at this time. And I think as an artist, you know, the one beautiful thing about being a celebrity, you can have access to the media. And, you know, instead of using it for negative, I choose to use it for good so that everyone that comes, like my heart gets full when I see, like when I saw the footage of people in Chicago marching and out there with those signs, no kings. And it was just beautiful because it was grandmothers and young kids and teenagers. And so what we're doing, you know, next weekend, the 6th and the 7th, is just raising money for the right cause to do the right thing and help in times like this.
And really, I think also just to bring people together, you know, just to have that sort of sense of community and communalism. And in that communalism, I think there is power. And you referenced, you know, some of these marches that have been going on peacefully for the most part. And that's what it's about. I mean, we're coming together. We all want the same thing. We all want good lives. We all want to love and be loved. And I mean, I think this is all kind of a celebration of that.
It really, you know, at the end of the day, I never look at anything as negative. Like even with all the turmoil that's going on in the country, so many new leaders and voices are being born because they can't take what they see. And that is good. Where they go, I was sitting on the sideline, but now I'm an activist. Now I'm going to do something. And so I know for me, it affects me. I look and I see grandmothers in wheelchairs, you know, going, no kings. I'm like, oh my God, look at that woman and look at that man. And so it just goes like, if they can do it, I can do it. And then if I can be, you know, a catalyst to, you know, ignite a fire among younger people that don't, you know, want to get involved and now will get involved. So, you know, this weekend, you know, next weekend, I just want to, it's a bit of a Trojan horse. You come out, you're going to have a good time. Like I said, our game night, you can play Scrabble, Uno, spades, bid whist, and just have fun.
Yeah.
And get to meet some people and just have a good time. So we're really going to have a good time for 2 days.
I love it. Well, we can all go to the website, eventnoir.com. I will, of course, link up to that through our channels. And this is great. This Robert Townsend pop-up film festival and more, really. You got the masterclass, you got the game night, you got a comedy night. You can get the whole schedule up at eventnoir.com. And hey, man, it's really great talking to you. Robert Townsend, legendary actor and director, and of course, the host of the Robert Townsend pop-up film festival next Saturday and Sunday here in Chicago. Thank you so much for talking to us today, Robert, and congrats on all of the work that you're doing, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Thank you so much for taking time to talk with me. You are simply the best. Thank you.
Here we are during a time of year when travel is at a very high level. Even when you're moving around the city and Chicagoland, you want to know if our area's public transportation is reliable. Back in 2023, I spoke to Brandon McFadden on this show. He's a cybersecurity analyst and a local developer, and he created the CTA and Metra Reliability Tracker. He did this in the name of transparency, so we can see the current service levels of the CTA and Metra. His site is brandonmcfadden.com. It's still up, and it has a lot of data. In this clip, we will hear why he started the site and how it works. So right now, let's rewind back to February of 2023.
So I moved to Chicago early last year, and a group of us that kind of met through a Facebook group were more or less complaining about how trains were not showing up and buses weren't showing up at the times that they were scheduled or the frequency that they were scheduled. And so we wanted to kind of put together a huge project that has, you know, conglomerated to Commuters Take Action and Ghost Buses and then myself, where we actually track and prove how many runs are happening on the system versus how many the CTA is saying they're going to run.
So this is interesting because I'm on your website now. I'm looking at it again, brandonmcfadden.com. And this reliability tracker, take us through how this works, because on the site here, there's this dashboard and there are a bunch of options that we can click for the CTA and Metra. How does this work?
So there's kind of two pieces to it. The back end of it is just a Python script that runs about once a minute. It's just running on a virtualized machine inside of the cloud. And what it does is it goes against the CTA's public APIs and checks to see if a train is arriving at a certain station within the system. So you'll see right there on the homepage of my tracker, it'll show what stations I'm actually using to kind of verify the reliability of the system. And so every single minute it goes and checks and says, you know, here's the station that I want to look at. And is there a train that's actually arriving there right now? And then I'm logging that into a huge database that has amassed hundreds of thousands of arrivals now. And then all of that data in the database is then converted into a kind of visual dashboard that you're looking at on my site that kind of gives a generalized availability of the data in a kind of easy to digest and understand format.
Right. There's a lot of data here, and which is great. But you take that data and you make it digestible, as you say, for all of us. So you do list a bunch of stations. And essentially what you're doing here is you're looking at the schedule times for, in this case, let's say the CTA and the L versus when the trains actually show up. So this data is out there, and I think maybe some of us hearing this conversation might be surprised by that, that we can get the data, or at least you can get the data of when these trains actually show up. So they release that.
Yeah, the CTA, they have a pretty great API that's available to anyone that would like it. You just have to apply on their developer portal, and they'll give you an access key that will allow you to go against this API. And they have multiple different endpoints available that give you kind of different pieces of information. Like there's one that'll show you like the exact location of every train in the system, or the one that I use is the arrivals API. And so it shows how many trains and what trains are going to come to a station next.
Hmm. So the API is basically like the data that you need.
Yeah, exactly.
So, okay, so I'm looking at it here, and there are sections here on your website on this CTA reliability tracker. So, for example, this gap occurrences, there's this button for gap occurrences, and you can go click on it, and you can break it down by the different color L line here. What does that mean?
The CTA says that at maximum, a train should arrive at a platform no more than every 15 minutes, most of the day. Some of the lines that run 24 hours a day, like the blue and red, have pretty slow schedule times, like up to a half hour over the real dark hours of the night and like 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so the gap occurrences page is showing how often a train arrives at longer than 30 minutes of scheduled time. So if a train arrives at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and another one doesn't show up until 2:45 in the afternoon, that's logged as a gap in service.
Interesting. So the higher the graph, does that mean then the more gaps there are in service?
Exactly. And then it's actually broken down by what time of day those gaps are occurring. And so you can see that during the daytime hours, you know, morning, afternoon, and evening, there's not as many gaps that occur, but those nighttime hours, the trains can get really stretched out on the line.
Yeah. Tell me about average headways. That's a section. What do you mean by that?
So the way that we calculate headways is you take the time from when the last time a train arrived at a station to the next time a train arrives at the station, and then the number of minutes in between. And so by averaging out the headways of the system, you can see kind of how a line is performing at various points in the day or over time. And so most of the lines, excluding the new schedules that were just published this month, should run between 7 and 12 minutes in headways. Sometimes that's longer just by nature of the schedule, or if some kind of incident is happening on the line, say a train is having a mechanical problem at a station along the line.
So we've been talking about the CTA here, but what about Metra? Because there's a section on this dashboard for Metra. Is it as easy to get that data as well?
Absolutely. So Metra just released their live tracking API pretty close to the beginning of this year. And the only problem is they don't have the live trackers on every single train in the system yet. So they can't exactly log a 100% day in my dashboard just because not all of the trains are tracked live. But the rollout of those trackers is expected to be completed by the end of this year. And just based on what I'm seeing already, Metra appears to be running 100% of their schedule every day, except for the occasional day where something goes wrong, whether a train goes out of service or whatever.
So as you have been doing this now for a little while and you look at the data, do you have enough information to have some takeaways here? What can we glean from this data? I mean, the CTA and Metra, are they running efficiently? Can you make any sort of determination based off of what you're seeing with the data trends?
Metra for sure is running efficiently. The API and the data that they're exposing show that their trains are running on time or within just a few minutes of scheduled time, which generally is acceptable for a public transit system. Whereas on the CTA side, they are struggling a little bit. Some of the lines, especially like the orange line, are running at 100% service or close to 100% service pretty consistently. Whereas other lines in the system, like the blue and brown and red, aren't necessarily doing as well. And some of that comes down to the operators pick their preferences on what lines they want to run. And so there are certain lines that are preferenced higher than others along the system.
So in terms of what we're seeing here, there are some maybe challenges for the CTA. Is the goal here to give this information to the Chicago Transit Authority and to Metra and to say, hey, you might want to take a look at this? Are they doing their own internal audit, or how is this working with what's going to, where this is all going to end up?
So the CTA has started publishing through their Meeting the Moment program. They've been publishing these monthly scorecards. And it's been nice to kind of see them become a little bit more transparent on their data and the fact that their data aligns fairly closely with the data that I've been collecting, which kind of gives me that reassurance that what I'm collecting is in fact accurate if what the CTA is providing is close or within a reasonable margin. And so they are becoming a little bit more transparent with their data, which has been really, really nice to see. But at the same time, they're kind of more or less flexing on the data that they're providing by saying, yes, they are becoming more reliable, but to do that, they have taken away a lot of the service that is offered. So like lines like the Blue Line have had hundreds of runs cut from their weekly schedules in order to kind of push them up to that 100% service level, but at the cost of not as many trains are running along the system.
Well, I think if anything, this is, you know, holding the feet to the fire when it comes to CTA, public transit systems here, Metra as well, and providing us, the public, with some more transparency about how these transit systems are running. It's public money, so we definitely want to keep that in mind as well. But this information is out there, and we can all go to BrandonMcFadden.com and check out the CTA and Metra reliability trackers. It's really cool what you did here, and we will link up to it, of course. Brandon McFadden is a cybersecurity analyst and developer here in Chicago. Brandon, thank you so much for talking to us today. This is really fascinating what you're doing, and I think it's pretty cool. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for giving me the time.
And that just about does it. Outside the Loop show number 998 is done. Thank you so much for listening to the show today. I hope you have a wonderful Thanksgiving weekend. And I hope you had a great just spread of all kinds of food. Special thanks, of course, to Bob Ferguson, who is our engineer on duty today in the WGN Radio studio. Have a great week as we get into December. I'll talk to you again next time right here on Outside the Loop.